Recently, there seems to be a lot of... Fail.
This is going to be a fucking long evening.
The power of metal compels thee.
The power of metal does not compel the rest of us, though, unfortunately.
It compels everyone. Welcome to Lug Radio, Season 5, Episode 14.
Indeed, 14 episodes into this.
Sadly for you lucky people, the Christopher Proctologist Extraordinaire cannot be with us tonight, so we have an extra competition this time. Everybody's looking at me blankly and slightly worried. You can win a ticket to Lug Radio Live in the USA, because Chris isn't coming anymore.
No, hang on.
Yeah, no, Chris is busy with Ron's daughter. Right now.
Unfortunately, when we changed the...
He's going to love that.
Yeah, he is. Unfortunately, when we switched the nights on Chris at the last possible moment, he couldn't make it anymore, I'm afraid.
It ought to be admitted that normally we recorded on a different night, and Jono decided to screw us all up very, very late.
I had a band practice. It was very important, and it was good practice.
You'll be pleased to know.
Really? You appear to have mistaken me for someone who gives two tugs of a dead dog's cock about your band.
Maybe if you were compelled by the power of metal, then you wouldn't have this problem.
Maybe, on the other hand, if you lot would give your music away as Creative Commons, then we'd have a better music industry, which we're going to talk about later in this show.
We are.
And also
did you
notice
the seamlessness of that segue, by
the
way?
I'm just panicking about, I can't remember what was in the show. Carry on.
We are going to talk about the Bojangles framework.
It's not called frigging Bojangles, it's called Django, the Python web framework.
We are also going to be talking to Rob Steve McQueen from Collabra about GStreamer, Fluendo, about multimedia, and all the cool stuff that they're doing over there.
Yep, we've got a very brief Lug Radio Live update.
Indeed.
And we've probably got some emails. Hopefully, because I can't remember anything else we spoke about.
And let's not forget, we are going to be announcing the winner of the Asa Raskin Stupid Hat Competition.
We are indeed.
So let's get on with it, shall we?
Okay.
I'm Adam Sweet.
I'm John O'Bacon.
And I'm Stuart Langridge. Welcome to Lug Radio.
Go away. Don't do that anymore.
Why?
You look like a fucking gimp.
Okay, on the phone right now we've got Rob McQueen from Calabria. Hiya, Rob.
Hi there.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine. It's been a busy week, but...
good.
Managing.
Right, I'd like to open the questions by asking you a somewhat stupid question. I always seem to be a bit behind the times with the cool stuff, so I wonder if you could tell me exactly what Calabria do?
Generally, open source consultancy, so writing software to meet our clients' requirements.
Right.
And ideally using wonderful open source technology and forwarding all batches back upstream.
Right.
Even if we are upstream, but doing that as much as possible. And the kind of main areas of business at the moment are telepathy projects, which I'm sure you've heard of, the intermeshing framework that sort of bring together voice over IP, chats, collaborative applications, that kind of thing, under one wonderful API, so that you can integrate them into your desktop, that kind of stuff. The Farsight media streaming library, which can put together the GStream pipelines you need for voice calls and video calls, that kind of thing. And recently we've been doing a reasonable amount of WebKit GTK hacking. So we've been working with Alpaca and pushing patches upstream to try and improve the situation there.
Now,
and, a few guys work on that.
We also have
the multimedia division, so the GStream hackers that we know and love. And they've been doing various contract work in sort of GStreamer portability work, improving support for different types of media, that kind of thing.
Now, earlier on you mentioned telepathy. There's been a huge amount of song and dance about telepathy, particularly in the GNOME community.
Yep.
And playing devil's advocate, I haven't really seen it go anywhere yet. What is actually going on with it? I mean, are people using it? Is it something that we can expect to see integrated into our desktops?
The main development effort that kind of would make it usable on the GNOME platform is the Empathy client, which is a fought off the Gossip XMPP client. So we've been kind of retooling that, so it acts as a front-end to telepathy. I guess the problem that telepathy has is that we've got all of this kind of wonderful plumbing in the back end, so we've got lots of kind of framework and lots of functionality that we've added for various client contracts. I mean, all of the IM stuff on the Nokia internet tablets is based on top of telepathy. And it's also what underpins all of the collaborative applications on the one laptop per child laptops. Cool. All of the kind of collaborative, like, you know, document editing, taking pictures, sharing files, that kind of stuff, that all runs on top of Telepathy. So most of the company has been working on all of this stuff on the back end, and this doesn't necessarily leave us with very many people to work on the kind of nice UI that we'll put it into the GNOME desktop. But we've been kind of funding some work on that, kind of on and off. A few students, cool. Particularly Xavier Kleisens is the kind of main developer on Empathy, and he's been making great progress. Kind of hooking in the functionality that Telepathy offers and then making it usable for the GNOME desktop. We've proposed it for GNOME 2.22. Didn't quite make it in. There's sort of a few question marks about licensing and documentation and things. But we're hoping to clean that up and actually have Empathy proposed and added for 2.24.
Excellent.
So hopefully we can get it into next release, and that puts Telepathy onto the desktop then, and kind of opens the way for other applications to hook in. Because part of the big benefit is that your connections, you know, XMPP, whatever IAM system you use, SIP, this kind of stuff, all present the same API. You can actually hook in other applications. You know, if you're doing a file transfer, it can turn up in Nautilus. If you're in Happy Word or whatever, editing document, you can, you know, do collaborative editing. You can share your desktop through VNC, this kind of stuff. There's a whole kind of chicken and egg situation that none of these applications at the moment hook in because nobody's using it for their normal IAMs and day-to-day stuff. On the other hand, people don't want to switch to the kind of day-to-day IAM stuff because we're maybe missing one feature here or there, that kind of stuff. So we're doing a bit of catch-up, and then hopefully we can kind of polish it so that people can use it as their kind of main IAM client. And then all of these opportunities for hooking it into other stuff kind of become a reality then.
Excellent. Slightly different, slight change of tack, I suppose. There aren't that many relatively high-profile open-source consultancy companies around, like Collabora. And I appreciate you can't talk about exact details of what kind of client contracts you do, but I get the impression that a lot of your work is kind of, you know, dark stuff that nobody actually hears about. So can you talk a bit about the sorts of things that you're asked to do, why companies approach you, and why there isn't more publicity around that kind of thing?
Yeah, a bit of an interesting question. I mean, our main clients at the moment, I mean, we are doing ongoing work on Telepathy for Nokia with the internet tablets.
Okay.
I'm going to have to tell you that.
Well, I mean, that is quite high profile, I admit it.
we've got a few guys who are working on the One Laptop Per Child project, who's kind of doing more kind of back-end infrastructure stuff there. Kind of bits and pieces necessary to integrate Telepathy onto the platform. We're also doing some development work kind of off our own bat at the moment. We're looking at Farsight 2, which should build on top of the new RTP support in GStreamer to add RTP conferencing, to do multi-way RTP calls, voice and video, kind of multi-person conferences, which kind of puts the ball back in the Telepathy court, which is that we need to support signaling this somehow, so we've got some work cut out for us there. But I mean, we've got some other work going on that I can't necessarily tell you about. But usually we try and sort of, even if we can't kind of be upfront about the work that we're doing kind of as we're doing it, we'll always try and go back and sort of make sure the patches are pushed upstream, make sure everything goes out into public. But usually the kind of the general people who we talk to are either people who are working with our software potentially on desktop situations and adding functionality that they want to use. And obviously a large chunk of my work comes from embedded devices, embedded sort of manufacturers who are interested in adding communications on their devices. And that's obviously an area where we have to maintain confidentiality because that's kind of, you know, the features of their product and what's coming out in 6 months' time is obviously sensitive.
Oh, well, of course, yeah. Okay, I mean, and the other thing you mentioned was WebKit GTK. I know Alptoke's been doing quite a lot of cool stuff with that. I mean, one of the flagship products of the open source community has been Firefox and Gecko Rendering Engine and so on, and there's this slight groundswell, a shift away from that and towards WebKit. What do you think about that? Do you think it's good that we've got two equally competent rendering engines, or do you think it kind of splits the force of what everybody's doing a bit?
I think there is a potential danger that there's a kind of division of effort. But on the other hand, I think it probably keeps Mozilla Foundation on their toes a bit. Because, I mean, it's not necessarily as a criticism to them, but certainly as a bit of a statement. They've had their priority being, you know, Firefox, Windows. So they've been aiming to produce a really nice polished browsing experience on the Windows desktop. And in some ways, the Linux has ended up, at least when perceived externally, Linux has ended up as being a sort of second-hand sort of priority for them. And this is particularly true in the kind of embedded space, where people kind of look at GTK Mozembed and bit of a pig, API break, this kind of thing. They try and integrate it into their mobile applications, and they run into a lot of problems. And I think that's where the kind of the support for GTK WebKit comes from, is because the goal isn't to produce a web browser. The goal is to produce the browser engine and to give it an API that's stable and that's easy to integrate into applications. So that's where WebKit becomes interesting for kind of dropping HTML, kind of Web 2.0 content into applications and using it as it's another widget, another way of drawing and presenting content. So there was some hacks that have been shown for using it in Pigeon as the widget that renders your text messages as they arrive. So obviously you've got all the HTML formatting there, but you can use those chat themes that Adium supports. You know, you can get kind of eye candy going in your application. So I think its strength is providing possibly a lighter weight browser engine, but you know, people in Mozilla Foundation will tell you different things. but also to provide an embeddable component that's more than a widget than a fully fledged web browser. So I think there's kind of space in the market, I guess, for both projects. Recently, the Mozilla Foundation has actually been kind of hearing some of this feedback, and they themselves have pushed in quite a lot of resources into better support on Linux and better embedded support, which I think is a good thing as well. I mean, anyone who's using it, anyone who wants to use it, they've got some good choices which they can evaluate.
Something which was obviously a fairly big thing that happened with you guys was that there was the mass exodus from Fluendo. And they've come over and they're part of your organisation. How's that working out? Because Fluendo, obviously, a big noise in the GStreamer world, and I think a lot of people, myself included, were a little bit worried that things were going to be a bit fucked up when it came to GStreamer, and there was going to be too much digression between the two organisations and things like that. How is it working out? Is it working well for the company, and do you think it's working well for GStreamer?
I think for Calabra, I mean, certainly the multimedia division is, I think, a net win for us, obviously. I mean, it's working out well commercially. The guys have got work kind of queued up. They're looking to hire people at the moment, or they're in the process of doing so. So, I mean, that's a kind of reasonably sure bet commercially. I think from the sort of community perspective, it hasn't had a negative impact on GStreamer, as far as I can tell. I mean, there are people who sort of come and go from Fluendo and maybe, you know, will come and work for us and stop working for us, this kind of thing. And I think the community has remained kind of reasonably good-natured. I think even the multimedia guys actually did some work for Fluendo while we were talking about it, that kind of stuff.
Right,
So, I mean, there's kind of back and forth, and I think the communication channels are kind of open, and, you know, everything goes on through the same way that it usually does, you know, through ISE, through Ming, it's that kind of thing. And I think we've still got kind of reasonably good sort of cooperation between different companies who are doing different things with GStreamer.
Right.
I think there was a sort of big fear that, oh my God, Fluendo's going to fall apart, it's all going to go horribly wrong. But I think that's not the case at all. I mean, Fluendo is around and it's doing various kind of, it's got different things on the go. It's working on kind of Pigment stuff.
Yeah.
And their set-top box kind of software. It is based on that. I think that's going well. And they've got guys who are hacking on that and contributing back to GStreamer as well.
But the big question is, of course, is Calabra going to pay Edward Hervey to do some Pitavi work? Because we're screaming out for a video editor, and we're struggling, you know? You guys can help us here, you know?
Well, they've got a few pokers in the fire, actually. They're trying to... The ideal for an open source company is, you know, you've got some work that you want to do, and you can find somebody who wants it done as well. So if you can kind of marry those two things, and you can actually get going on something with some funding.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, it's something you should talk to Christian about.
Nicely deferred. Well, Rob, good friend of the show, and thank you so much for coming on to talk to us. And it's been emotional. In fact, we're all sat here. And we're very emoted.
We've been chopping onions or something.
No, it's just Adam. He's got a bit of a body odor problem right now. So, but we appreciate it, and we'll catch up with you soon.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Cheers, Rob.
Bye. Okay, dude.
In recent months, there's been an awful lot of discussion about DRM, and we've seen Nine Inch Nails have announced their album that's going to be released and not under the DRM thing. Shame, you know, it's great. Shame Nine Inch Nails are shit. Well, but it's a good move forward.
The interesting thing about the Nine Inch Nails thing is not that it's DRM-free, because you can now get DRM-free music from all four major labels.
Mini Nova.
It's that it's Creative Commons, which means you can actually legitimately go to Mini Nova and download it. Were you to think of going to Mini Nova to download albums?
I heard about Mini Nova from you.
Yeah, because I download Linux distributions from it. Anyway, right?
And Nine Inch Nails albums.
I mean, yeah, that's right, isn't it?
Nothing else.
Yeah, you keep coughing there.
Yes, absolutely. But that's what's interesting about this. Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails, they put together this new... It's an instrumental album, which is interesting. And you can download the first... There's 9 parts to it, I think. And you can download the first part of it completely for free, and you can download the whole lot for $5 or $10 or something, I think. It's not very much. But it's all Creative Commons licensed. So they've actually said, well, you know, you can go and get it off BitTorrent sites or for your mates or whatever.
No,
they actually uploaded it to the Pirate Bay themselves.
Now, I think that's interesting on one side, but what I'd like us to talk about is that I wonder whether this is going to screw with the economics of the music industry, right? And what I mean by that is that, as I've said, I believe, on this very podcast many times before, is that when you get signed, the big thing that you get when you get signed is you get distribution, so you get your record in shops. Mm-hmm. Adam will testify this when, you know, sold...
Yeah, you do if you don't... you're not signed to Adam's record label.
They you know, Adam sold... 6 or 7
10 years of bitterness still going strong.
No, Adam sold 600 or 700 records.
It might be 2,000 or 3,000.
I think his mum's still got 250 of them.
Big box. It's like in Del Boy's flat.
Moving on.
We should not be mean to Adam's band.
So anyway, obviously distribution is one aspect. You get your record in shops. And then, of course, the main thing is publicity and promotion and tours. It's not so much the act of recording a record. It's the stuff that it provides you. Now, I wonder if, you know, if record labels basically, their cash cow is selling records. I mean, they're selling T-shirts, but invariably a lot of bands do that themselves. But it's you make money from ticket sales at gigs, you make money from selling records, and, of course, you make money from merchandise. If they're taking out the ability to make money, because DRM is basically bollocks and it doesn't work. We all acknowledge that. So basically, there's no better solution other than really releasing music that has the possibility of being copied and ripped and put on BitTorrent or whatever. Or just giving the music away quite legitimately open, like with the Nine Inch Nails thing. So you're taking that aspect away, which there's still the aspect of, obviously, is live performances, which is a good thing. But who's going to pay for the tours? And I'm wondering, I'm not saying this is my viewpoint, but I'm wondering how this is all going to work with this new age of music. I mean, how are people going to be able to fund tours and get the publicity out there when they can't make some money from the records?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, imagine for a moment that the current music industry didn't exist, and I came to you and I said, Jono, I've got an idea. People should be able to have a career making music. There are people out there making music. They should be able to, you know, get some money from this. How would you set up the world so that's possible? And one way you could invent is the way the current music industry works, but there are other ways. I mean, to pick an example, right, Lug Radio Live, how are we funding that? That's basically a tour.
Drugs.
I mean, it's one shot tour, but how are we funding that? So one way you could do it is to go with sponsorship.
Yeah,
I mean a way you can get around the publicity thing. I mean, in my kind of view of the world, a lot more music was Creative Commons, for example. So the big deal wasn't that you had to buy albums. How would you get discovered if you didn't have record labels in there doing marketing for you? I see music journalism becoming a lot more important. Rather than the NME just getting sent demos and picking the ones they like and playing them, they actually go out and find new bands.
Well, the thing is,
because to my mind, one of the big things that record labels do is A&R. They'll go out there, they'll find new artists, and importantly, they'll find new artists and put them together with good new good producers or whatever. Mm-hmm. A good A&R man, not fucking sleazy suit A&R men, but a you know, the sort of A&R man who you want your band to meet, I suspect, mm-hmm. is the sort who say, ah, well, there's we've got a producer who'd be really great to do your first album and put you together with them, so you get a great sound.
But that's the thing is that. But the thing is, looking at again the economics of it, if you were to a typical thing that a band will do is record a record and do a tour. Right?
Yeah.
So to do that, you're going to have to pay for the studio time. You're going to have to pay for the tour dates, you know, the venues, the crew, the travel, the riders, mm-hmm. the groupies, the drugs, the booze, yeah. all the important things that are part of a tour.
I think groupies generally come free, by the way.
Okay.
I don't think you have to pay for those.
It's the voice of experience, is it?
Sadly not, no.
It ought to be pointed out that a groupie you have to pay for isn't a groupie. You can get groupies you have to pay for even if you're not a band.
Did you get many groupies on the Radio 1 Roadshow?
No. We got lots of offers of kisses, and they were all about 15 and incredibly spotty, and we avoided.
Nice.
Thank you. Yes, moving on.
Well resisted.
So there's the cost of putting the tour on, there's the cost of the recording itself. Hang on a second. Oh, and then there's there's things like, you know, so for example, if you want to get this new band on a Terrorizer, you know, if it's a metal band on Terrorizer magazine, if they want to put a song on their cover disc, then you have to pay for it. And you have to pay for advertising in magazines, you have to pay for all of these different bits and pieces. So what I'm saying is that there's a reasonably significant amount of upfront money required, which is required anyway with any new band. But I'm wondering how much of that can be reaped back from merchandise and from ticket sales.
It's not that it necessarily, from my perspective, it's not necessarily that it can be reaped back. You could wire the world so it works a different way. You know, so a lot of the stuff you're talking about there, imagine Seraphidion, right? Jono's band. Mm. Imagine you all sat there in the pub and you said, we'd love to go on tour. Right, that's what we actually want to do. We don't have a record deal, but we want to go on tour anyway. How would you fund it? Would you just go, well, we can't, that's the end of it, fuck it. That's that dream gone away until David Geffen knocks on the door.
Depends.
If you wanted to do it, if you thought going on tour is really important to us, because that's what we want to do with our lives for the next 12 months, you'd find a way of paying for it.
But going on tour it depends on. So, for example, you can fund a self-run tour, and that's what we did, you know. It's like you basically play a load of gigs around the country or another country or whatever, and you basically rough it. That's what you do.
Yeah.
Right? And every band does that. But if you want to support, like, if we wanted to support, let's say, I mean, we supported Anthrax at the Wolf Run. If we wanted to support Anthrax on their tour, we'd have to pay for it.
Well, yeah, okay. So think about this, right? Imagine you weren't a band. Imagine you were going to set up a company that made spice racks, right? And you needed 15,000. I've got no idea how much a tour costs, right? If I gave you £20,000, could you do a reasonable tour? No kind of tour at all?
Across the UK?
Across some of the UK. If I gave you £20,000 and said, could you do a tour? I mean, would you not get out of Wolverhampton for that?
Are you talking about supporting a bigger act? Are you talking about yourself?
I don't know. Give me an example. I'm looking for a rough
figure. Could support a bigger act across the UK tour for £20,000.
Right, okay. Yeah. So imagine you were setting up a company that sold spice racks and you needed £20,000 to get it off the ground, to build a factory or whatever. Where's your record label? There isn't one. So what you do is you go to the bank and you'd say, I believe we can make money back on this. Like, there's no reason why bands can't do that. But in fact, there's this whole music industry people who
No. But there's only so many times you can do that. You have to you do that, right?
Yeah.
And you do that with the idea of raising your profile. And once you've raised your profile, you can sell ticket sales because your profile's out there. People are buying your records or people are listening to your music.
So your £20,000 tour wouldn't make money. It would lose money. You basically take that 20 grand and burn it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Why?
The problem with the music industry is, first of all, to raise your profile to such a level where people actually want to pay for your music, you have to have a massive budget behind you to pay for the tour, because most tours are, unless you're a big band, all tours lose money.
Mm.
Almost all singles in the UK top 40 lose money, but they're a loss leader for albums.
Yeah.
So to be noticed enough, being good helps, obviously, but to be noticed enough for people to go and buy your records to make money, you need, you need a record label behind you, which is kind of like having a big venture capitalist.
That's exactly what it is. It's VC funding.
It's VC, that's the point.
But the thing is that, what my point here is that,
Sorry to interrupt. Without that, nobody hears who you are. And I guess I don't see how a music industry could survive without a record label. I mean, if you look at all the bands that are doing this kind of thing, not necessarily the Creative Commons thing, but basically cutting the record label out of the scenario, like Radiohead and Madonna's tours are managed by herself and not her management company or her
record
label.
They're all huge.
Yeah, they're already established, and so they've already got the profile to...
They're based on the spoils of the record. Yeah.
Why aren't music journalists going out there and fight? I mean, it's quite easy to be a music journalist. All you have to do is look at the list of gigs that someone else has set up and then just pick one that you fancy.
Music journalists are going out there and finding new bands all the time. Yeah.
Why isn't that working more then? What is happening?
What are you expecting to happen from that?
The idea is you're saying you can't get famous without someone pushing you on the public. Yes. But if music journalists are finding the bands, then why isn't that making bands famous?
Joe Public every day that you saw on the street isn't interested in seeing bands that your man in the Melody Maker wrote about last week enough to go and buy.
I would agree with you, but neither of you were in pop bands. Right? Yeah, I totally agree. There's this whole big hole in my plan for where mass market pop fits in. But metal stuff isn't being found like that. Metal people, Joe Public isn't interested in metal music at all.
No, but what happens with, I'll give you an example. I mean, using metal as an example.
Yeah, because it's something you know more about.
Right. I don't read any metal publications. I don't read Metal Hammer, I don't read Kerrang, I don't read Terrorizer, because there's a lot of shit in those magazines. I like pretty aggressive metal. And that kind of stuff invariably isn't covered as much in those magazines. So therefore, I don't tend to read those magazines. And also, I like the bands I like, and I discover bands primarily from going to see bands that I like, and I see good bands supporting them.
That's exactly my point. That's the point I'm trying to make. The record labels aren't pushing these new bands on you. You're going to find them because they're supporting other bands.
Who do you think's paying for the tours?
Well, we just discussed that. You said you could fund a tour supporting Anthrax for 20,000.
You could.
Which you could borrow.
Where would you get that money from?
You borrow it off the bank.
But the point...
You can't pay it back.
But you can't pay it back. That's the point.
But the bands you're... So the bands you're finding out about, you're not actually buying their records.
I am buying their records.
Then why aren't they making money?
But records don't make money.
Yeah, the records don't make money.
Unless enough people are buying them.
Like I've said before, people...
What you're describing then is a world in which basically metal or any other minor genre can't make money.
Unless you're a major act.
Unless you're one of the top 25
unless you're a major
bands
act,
in the world,
you won't make much money.
Most bands are self-financed.
I'll give you an example, you're
saying the music industry is going to die, right? Because you can't make money being a band. But you already can't make money being a band if you're not a pop band.
What I'm saying is, so I'll give you an example. A band called Overkill that I listen to, they're their own business, they do it full time. But for a significant part of their career, they were working normal jobs. They were doing, they had a record contract. They were recording. They were doing well. All the rest of it, okay. And but it's a case, literally a case of replacing costs. They're not making a huge amount of money from it. Now you compare that to someone like Metallica, who new guy joins the band and they can offer him a $1 million advance instantly. Because they've got that much money.
Ignore the top 20 bands.
The point is, in terms of smallish bands. So, the difference between Overkill and Seraphidion is marginal. You know, we could theoretically do what they're doing if we wanted to. We could set up our own business. We could go and get funding from the bank. And we could do the same kind of thing. But you need to get your album out in terms of distribution. Right, that's one aspect. And that might go away in terms of the internet. Absolutely. Yeah. But you need just having the money to put a tour on and having the money to get yourself in some of the publications, because a lot of people will read the media magazines, right?
Yeah.
But having the money to do that is one thing, but also it's natural that it becomes competitive in the fact that if you've got bands like Metallica and huge bands and then even smaller scale bands like big metal bands like Primal Fear and bands like that who have got a lot of money behind them, they're playing all the big festivals. They're going to be swallowing up the smaller bands who haven't got as much money to push themselves forward because there's a huge amount of competition in this space.
What I don't understand is you're saying the music industry is going to go away. People give away their music Creative Commons.
I'm not saying that at all. Like I said at the start of the segment, I'm not saying that's my perspective.
You're suggesting that might happen, but as far as I can tell, what the hell are the music industry doing now for bands who aren't Metallica? If you're not one of the top 25 metal bands in the world, what are your record label doing for you that Overkill weren't doing for themselves?
Well, let's compare two contrasting perspectives.
They're giving
right?
you the opportunity.
Let's compare two things.
So they're acting as a VC.
Basically, yeah.
So imagine...
I'll let Johnny speak and I'll...
Imagine Seraphidian, right? Two options, right? We have either have a record contract or we don't, right?
Yeah.
So we get a record contract, we sign to Metal Blade or someone, and we get a one album, one tour deal, right? We do a tour around the UK, probably do 8 or 10 dates, a couple of dates in Europe. We have a record out, it goes into the shops, it goes sent out to the magazines. If it gets good reviews... we start building a fan base, right? So from that instantly, you get magazine exposure, you get a tour, you get a record in the shops that everyone can buy, and you know a significant amount of people are going into record shops and buying them, looking through the racks and buying records. Okay, that's one aspect. Now, what we could do alternatively is that we could theoretically get some money from the bank, which I don't know if they give us the money, right? Is one aspect. If we do manage to get the money,
are lots of people doing this. Banks will start to get involved with it.
There's lots of people doing this and being able to pay the money back.
Well, yeah.
I don't think banks are ever going to lend money to bands unless it's guaranteed against something because it's such a high-risk venture.
Exactly. So what happens is
there are high-risk ventures all the time. Digging for gold is a high-risk venture.
Imagine for a second that I actually managed to get the money from the bank. Yeah. Okay. What that will buy me is that will buy me a tour, potentially. And that will probably buy me some recording time, but that won't buy me much more than that, right?
Okay.
It won't get me hardly any publicity because record labels are, you know, it's about who you know and connections and all that kind of stuff. That's the work that they do. In the same way that you talked about Lug Radio Live. Lug Radio Live has been more successful in the latter years because we've developed connections and we can go up to people and say, can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this? Can we do this? Because we've got the connections. When we started out, we didn't have any connections. I mean, we had some connections from where we work. But it's much harder, right? So with a label, you're not only getting monetary funding, but you're also getting the experience of those people being able to put you in the right places. That's what you're paying for. So like if Arch Enemy are going to play a gig in London, the label might be able to get us to support them or something like that. That's the kind of thing that you're paying for.
What I don't understand is, if your music was Creative Commons, how much difference would it make to that? You can still put records in shops... And people can still go in and buy them.
Because a significant amount of funding, a significant amount of sales comes from records.
But Adam just said records lose money.
Ah, albums make money. If you think, right, probably there are maybe 100, 200 records that come out every week. And they're singles, perhaps. Say 250 singles come out every week. Only 40 get into the top 40.
Yeah.
And probably, most of the time, not even number one makes a profit.
Okay.
Because they're always a loss leader for albums. And if you say that maybe 50 albums, 100 albums come out a week, most of those will never see the light of day again. Probably the top 20 or top 40 will make money. It's basically a gamble. And the record companies are paying to take the gamble in the hope that they will earn enough money off you to fund another venture, which will, again, hopefully make more money for them. Probably 10%. Probably 10 or 15, 25% of what they spend, of the bands or the artists that they fund, make money. The rest don't make any money.
But I don't understand what difference it would make if you gave that music away. Because your argument for it sounds suspiciously close to the, if everyone who downloaded an MP3 bought the record, then we'd have this much money argument, which we all know is bollocks. Because most people who downloaded the thing wouldn't have gone out and bought the record.
I think fundamentally it's that as a record label, if you can make money from selling records, and you can make some money from selling merchandise, and you can make money from ticket sales, right? Then you've got three avenues of making money, right? The first thing that you need to be able to do is to get that music out to people. And admittedly, you could do that with free music. I'm not denying that. But you can make money from that as well. And I think that's the thing, I think the margins are so slim as it is.
You think there's a significant portion of people at the moment? You've got sort of two classes of people. You've got people who download the music for free, rip it off in some way, and you've got people who go into a record shop and buy an album. Right?
Yeah.
If you said you can download this for free, but if you go into the record shop and buy it, it's still going to cost you 11 quid or whatever a CD costs these days, right? You think there's a significant portion of people who were buying the CD already who would download it for free? I don't. I think there's a lot of people who were downloading it already who will download it still, but there aren't that many people
I don't understand how you've drawn that parallel. What I'm saying is that I'm saying that there's a significant number of people out there who will go out and buy the CDs today.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely. People will go out and buy the CDs today for whatever reason.
But you think a lot of those people, if the music was downloadable for free, if they would stop buying the CDs and download the music instead, but they're not currently prepared to go and download it for nothing.
Because that would be stealing.
I think the people that go and buy hard discs.
Yeah.
Hard discs.
But yeah, I know what you mean.
Physical media.
A compact disc with music on.
Are half and half big fans of the artist and like having a tangible item they can hold in their hand and pop in the CD.
And those people will continue to buy CDs even if your music was Creative Commons. Yeah.
And the other half are people that don't realise that if they put in a bit of effort and a bit of Googling and actually understand how to do it, you can go and get it for nothing illegally.
Yeah.
So you think it's just that they're not aware of file-shared music?
At
least they don't know how to go and do it.
Would they be more aware of file-shared music were it legitimate?
Yes.
Because why?
Because everybody wouldn't know. If it were legitimate, people would know.
I can't believe there are people in the world who listen to popular music, not necessarily classical music, but who haven't at least heard the term MP3 these days.
My case in point here, because I still buy CDs.
Exactly.
If I like the band,
and
I go and buy the CD.
And I think you continue to do so.
But there's a couple of other things which I think are interesting, but we don't really have time to talk about. One thing that I find interesting is that I think we're going to end up with a higher quality of music if we see more people releasing stuff under the Creative Commons. Because one of the things, particularly in the early thrash metal days, like when Metallica and Megadeth and bands like that were kicking around the Bay Area scene, the only way people got to know about new music was swapping tapes.
Yeah.
Was copying cassettes. Which is why when Metallica sued Napster, it was such a kick in the balls because it was like,
that's how they got popular.
They completely just blew away their roots. And, you know, Lars Ulrich openly confesses that was a bit of a mistake.
Yes.
But, you know, a lot of these bands, particularly these early bands, didn't have any problems getting record deals. They didn't even go out looking for record deals because there were so few bands at the time who were trying this style of music and everybody was sharing it that basically they started getting a fan base because people were sharing the music so much, because people were hearing about it so much. I think that in summary, that we will end up with better music, better bands, more interesting music, more experimental music.
There will certainly be less shit foisted upon us.
Yeah, but using, you know, if people embrace the Creative Commons. However, I do think that it's tempting to be glib and say, oh, you know, yeah, we can do this and have free music, but I don't think it's that simple. I don't think we can get there
from where we are now.
Yeah. We're going to have to think of some new ways of doing stuff, and maybe that is things like sponsorship deals and you know, deals with being able to, you know, have songs in Guitar Hero and stuff like that.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, there's this whole kind of extra... what I'm talking about here, you say, what about if you gave your music away for free? And it sounds like it's a quite simple thing, and it requires this huge, complete shake-up. This is why I said at the beginning, you know, if you sat down and designed how you want the music industry to work, one way you could design it the way it works now, but you could design it a different way, but you'd have to change everything.
Unfortunately for me, I think people are just lazy. People don't have the time to go out there and look for new bands all the time, which is why people kind of more or less blindly accept, which is basically what's put in front of you by the radio and the TV and whatever magazine.
I tell you what, and this is the reason why everybody should be using Last.fm. I've discovered so many new bands from listening to Last.fm, particularly like where it shows the bands you might like in Banshee. It's like, I've listened to so many new bands using that because it's a site that enables... It's the only social networking site, apart from Facebook, that I think has been useful in that regard.
Yeah, the only other thing I wanted to say is I don't want to sound like I'm rubbishing your idea. Because my perspective is coming from... I've seen the way it works from the inside. I wasn't that close to the middle, but...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I mean, I saw the inside, and I understand how it works now. And my fear is that if bands start giving away their music, we'll never hear about them. Because record companies aren't going to want to touch them, because some of they're going to see part of their revenue stream from that artist disappearing.
And there's going to be such a huge swathe of bands foisted on
them. Let's not forget when the stars are bright in front of your face, people get greedy, don't they? Mm. Everybody wants the money and the glory and not doing the right thing.
You may recall a couple of shows ago, we had a plaintive email from usability guru Aza Raskin.
Yes.
Complaining that he'd lost his hat in some kind of freak mountainside accident. And John DiCarlo was so moved by this, and the fact that he slid down a stream never to be seen again, that they released Enzo Launcher as open source, which I've been hacking on. Well done, Jono.
It's great, thanks.
Most famous Jono on the internet. Anyway, moving swiftly
Google
on.
Google says otherwise.
You've ruined Jono Bacon's life plan here, by the way.
I have. And he thought he was going to be the most famous person by having a really obscure name. and he hasn't even got the best sideburns of any Jono.
Did you notice as well that he wrote a blog entry saying, sideburns shivering with fright,
Which I do think was quite amusing.
And incidentally, no word from Raskin. I'm a bit worried about seeing him at Look Radio Live.
Just in case he turns out to be some kind of kickboxer guy or something, you know.
It'd be the hatchet murder.
Any hat be being the operative word.
It would be funny if he was wearing a new hat, wouldn't it?
Anyway, importantly, he said that he'd lost his hat and perhaps we could help out. So we asked some of you to send in pictures of how Aza would look in a new hat. And to quote Adam, this one really brought the freaks out of the woodwork. You should all feel very proud of yourselves. We will put a selection of the entries that we had.
Read all of the entries.
Up at lugradio.org/hat.
Mm.
But we should announce a winner. The winner wins, by the way, the Lug Radio Finger of God, coveted and prestigious that it is.
It's in the display case here at Lug Radio Towers.
It is, yeah.
Oh, yes, it is. It really is in the display cabinet, right on top of Jono's desk, just in front of him.
But we would like to say, we were actually torn between two entries, and then it turned out they were both by the same person. So, our winner is... Richard Quirin.
Thanks for that. Puppy powers. Well,
so, Richard Quirin, well played. If you send us your address, we will send you the lug radio finger of God post haste.
Very nearly bodged it up.
Very nearly lug radio ringer of God.
I know, absolutely. And who wants the ring of God?
Moving on. The entries were very good. We had some deeply
weird ones.
Weird and concerning entries. Particularly one by, I can't remember the guy who did it, but there was one which was like a forest kind of scene with each of our faces on different animals. Adams.
I was a fucking teddy bear with a red bow tie.
The best one is Chris Proctor.
It's
just like a tiny ball of fluff with Proctor's face on it.
I was amused that you were a cow with a fucking bell around
your neck. So, yeah.
I think, to be honest with you, mental association here, Jono was bull.
Thank you very much.
Strong like bull, I mean, obviously.
This is...
As opposed to having a bell around his neck so all the village members can avoid the village idiots.
Move away from me and the bull?
Anyway, Richard Quirin, send us your address and we will dispatch you the Lug Radio Finger of God. Congratulations. And Aza, we're very, very sorry. Please don't beat us up.
Yeah, we'll see you in
see you in a month.
Shivering. Sideburns with fright. Okay, ladies and gentlemen and Nero, as some of you may be vaguely aware, we've got this little event going on in San Francisco.
There is nobody who listens to this show who is not thinking, shut the fuck up about Lug Radio Live USA. Either I've already bought a ticket or I live in Philadelphia or possibly, Antarctica and I'm not going.
So we have Lug Radio Live USA 2008. It's happening at the Metreon in San Francisco. As we've mentioned before, there's going to be over 35 speakers.
April 12th and 13th,
yes.
By the way.
And it's over 35 speakers. There's going to be probably about 45
exhibitors.
We've been working hard on it. We've got some great stuff lined up. And a few things of note that will be of interest to our listeners. Prizes are available, aren't they, fellas?
They are
available. So if you go to lugradio.org/live and click on the American flag, you will see that there is a register link on the website. We're encouraging people to pre-register, as we do every year. But... if you go and register, once you've actually filled in your credit card details to get the ticket, which is $10, you can also type in the name of the person who might have referred you to Lug Radio Live. So if you are going to Lug Radio Live, or if you like the idea of it, and you want to tell people about it, they can put your name in there. Now, the person who's got the most number of names in that box, as in if you've referred the most number of people, you can win yourself either an Asus Triple E PC, which is donated kindly by efficientpc.co.uk, our friends over there.
Yeah.
Or you can...
Usefully with a British plug.
Or you can choose to have... Or you can choose a Neurus OSD, which is kindly donated by Neurus. In addition to this, so you can pick one of those two, and you can also win two O'Reilly books and a limited edition Lug Radio t-shirt. Now, the cool thing as well is that every single person that you refer, so they're also, you know, in on the winnings, they are going to be getting an O'Reilly book and a limited edition Lug Radio t-shirt. So there's prizes afoot for everybody.
There are.
Now, this... The key point
is, if you're going... Tell your friends.
Tell your friends. Encourage your friends to get along. It's going to be an awesome event. We've got a load of people coming down. It's going to be good fun. So make sure you refer people. And 12th and 13th of April it is.
And if you're bored about us hearing about talking about the event in America, don't forget we'll be doing it in the UK in July, isn't it?
In July. 19th and 20th of July.
So we'll be getting to you guys soon.
Don't worry. You're going to be getting sick of Lug Radio Live every episode.
Sell the show, dude. Sell the show.
Bojangles! So, Bojangles. It's got nothing to do with Django. Mr. Langridge, you've been talking about Django recently.
I have been talking about Django recently.
And getting annoyed when I refer to it as Bojangles.
Yes, you are.
Did you enjoy that start to the segment?
I did not enjoy that start to the segment. No, I mean, we were chatting about what to talk about, and I said I've been using Django a lot recently. New job.
So it's a web... framework, right?
It's a web framework, yes, indeed.
Now, we know nothing about this, as in Adam and I.
Yeah, I'm fully prepared to ask lots of stupid questions.
And we thought it would be interesting, because we did a segment a while back asking Adam and Chris a load of questions about virtualization, because Ak and I were, you know, stupid.
Yes.
Well, and still are stupid, in fact.
Yes.
So, let's... Why should we care about Django? Sorry, Bojangles.
Well, you should only care about it if you're a web developer.
Isn't that the mouse out of the Green Mile? Moving on.
I don't know.
Is that mouse in the Green Mile?
Never mind.
Was that a question directed at me?
Anyone.
We were talking about Django.
Don't take it.
Why should you care about it? If you're developing web applications,
yes,
it's a really good way to do it.
Why?
Because it takes a lot of the stuff that you have to do and makes it really, really easy.
Like Ruby on Rails?
Yes. It's quite similar to Rails.
Right, okay.
One of the big things that Django's got that Rails hasn't... I appreciate I'm skipping over a big thing about... I'm assuming you know about Rails a bit here.
Yeah. But I'm going to rewind you about that.
You can rewind in a moment. But one of the good things that Django does, you define... Say you're building a web application based on a database. Hmm. So you're building something to manage your collection of CDs, for example. Mm. So you just tell Django, okay, there's a CD kind of object, right? And a CD has a title and it has an artist and it has a cover picture, say.
Yeah.
And then Django takes care not only of managing all that, getting it all into the database and all that sort of thing, but it builds all the forms you need to type it all in.
Right, okay. So it builds a UI as well as the database side of things.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that different to Ruby on Rails?
Rails doesn't do that.
Okay.
They call it the admin. If you're building a public website, you've got the public side of it, and then you've got the private side of it, where you actually type all the information into it. And you have to build all that stuff, but nobody ever sees it. And it's this really annoying task where you have to build all these forms.
Now,
and Django does it all for you.
Something I find interesting about it is when I was working at OpenAdvantage, we used to spend, you know, we'd do work with businesses would come in or individuals would come in and they'd be interested in, they want to have a website, which particular framework do we use? And we were big fans of Ruby on Rails and things like Mambo or Joomla as it is now, which is obviously more of a CMS. Now, this is written in Python, right?
Yes.
And it seems that these things are easy to learn. In terms of, they allow you to automate a lot of things, but actually learning all of the different bits and pieces and how they fit together is actually quite a lot to take on. Do you think Django is easy for someone who's got some basic Python skills to get started with?
It's easier, I would say it's easier for someone who's got some basic Python skills to get started with building web applications with Django, then it is that's easier than someone who's got some basic web skills but no Python.
Right.
Because Django, Rails, a lot of them work a different way from websites of the past, where each page was a kind of an individual thing. You'd write a PHP page and put it up, and then another PHP page and put it up.
And I'm assuming it automates everything, like, you know, like a lot of time when you write PHP is error checking and all that kind of stuff. I'm assuming that it automates all that kind of stuff.
A lot of that stuff's all handled for you. Absolutely.
So this was written by Harry Potter and some other dude, right? Guy in the broom.
Poor old Simon Willis. what it was? It was written for the Lawrence Journal World, who are a newspaper in
somewhere in
Kansas. I think the town's actually called Lawrence, hence Lawrence Journal World. But it was they started off building a brand new website for the newspaper, and they wanted a way of allowing journalists to publish articles and stuff to the web easily. And as they started building the site, they realized that they were kind of building this framework to build sites on top of.
Mm.
And then they went, well, why don't we open source it? So they did. Hence Django, named after Django Reinhardt.
Why?
Because they need to call it something.
But why him?
So why not name it after a jazz guitarist?
Why not name...
Let's not have the debate about where he's from.
Why didn't they call it, like, Marty Friedman?
Feel free to direct your question to Adrian Holofas.
Who?
One of the guys at...
Isn't that a make of really inferior Italian pieces?
Harsh. No.
Not Olivetti. Harsh.
Okay. No. I'm going to interrupt you both now. I'm going to ask you some stupid sysadmin, server admin kind of questions.
That's fine.
Right. I'm looking at it from an operating system and Apache point of view, right?
Yes.
Where does Django sit in the stack, as it were? I guess you need your OS, you need Apache, and I assume Mod Python.
Yes, well, you do need Mod Python. It's not like existing stuff. Pages, you have to get away from the model that a URL that you visit maps to a page on the file system. That's not the way it is. Not the way it is with Django, it's not the way it is with Rails, nothing like that. Your URLs are like a user interface for these things. It's not just, you know, publish a page by putting a file at that place.
Yeah.
You know. So the way you deploy it, you can do it one of a number of ways. Slightly boring Python talk coming up here.
No, come on.
But you've got Mod Python, which allows you to plug Python into Apache and then you run it on. I mean, theoretically, you could run it so every time someone visits a URL, it starts up Python and then starts up all of Django, works out the stuff that needs to come back to the user from that URL, and then shuts it all down again at the end. That's how CGI works.
Right.
The problem with doing that is that then it would take 15 seconds to start every page. Mm-hmm. Right? That's obvious. Well, it wouldn't, but you know what I mean. It'd take a long time. That's obviously a pain in the ass. So essentially the way all of these things work, the way Rails works, the way the Perl one works, the way Django works, the way TurboGears works, which is a different Python one, is that you have a kind of a long-running Python process which is sitting there being Django, and then Apache just kind of talks to it. It's like a proxy, almost.
It's like a client-server kind of thing.
Sort of. I mean, there's a lot of individual little wrinkles in this. The Python people have defined a thing called WSGI, which is a way of plugging a server like Apache into something running like Django.
Are you trying to think of a comedy acronym?
For WSGI, yes.
I was actually trying to think of a comedy acronym.
Oh, so was I, is it?
Put a stop to it.
And then it reminded
people.
Me of when we were talking about packaging, and I referred to a pea builder, and someone said, what's that? And someone else said, it builds peas.
I think that may have been me.
Sorry, it just made me smile.
Okay, right. I mean, this is that's all implementation detail. If you get into web programming, specifically web programming in Python, then WSGI is useful. But
so the big question is Python a lot slower than running PHP? I mean, PHP was referred to one of, I think it might have been Chris Jones, who was on the show, who works at Canonical, as like, it's like allowing a very, very large bus full of hackers into your data center running PHP applications. Not a big fan of PHP, but PHP seems to be known for being quicker, isn't it?
Well, a lot of optimization work went into PHP, and because PHP stuff tends to be more Traditionally, it was more page-based. You know, you went to a URL that mapped to a page on the file system. Your PHP interpreter interpreted that page and returned the results.
Yeah.
There are now frameworks written in PHP which work the same way Django does, the same way Rails does. There's one called Symfony, for example.
Right.
So people are tending to move away from this one URL equals one file system file model. They're moving away from that and towards a thing where you run an application and it presents a user interface, which is your individual URLs.
It runs along. So basically, back to my kind of admin direction, it basically runs as a kind of long-standing process.
Yeah,
which
essentially.
Which you talk to.
Yes.
And from a user interface perspective, as I said, I'd be setting it up and then I'd be using it. I wouldn't be developing it. I basically, Django has an interface which you basically build stuff in.
Yeah.
That you create content in. And
yeah. I mean, I mentioned databases earlier, but you don't have to use Django for database-driven sites. Most of the things that people build with Django are database-driven, but that's, frankly, because most of the stuff on the web is database-driven.
Now, you used to have quite a rant against databases. Have you changed your perspective on that?
Not particularly. The reason I used to rant against databases is precisely because it annoys me when people require you to set up MySQL and set up a database when you're only going to be storing 300 or 400 things. You might as well just store them on the file system. It's easier to back up. It's easier to deal with. There's no long-running process to fall over, right?
You don't have to go through an intermediary piece of software when things go wrong.
Yes.
No, and a couple of interesting things have come up since then. One of them is SQLite has really taken off. So now you get all the benefits of storing stuff on the file system. SQLite, for those of you who don't know, is a full-on SQL database, but all the stuff's stored in one file. Mm-hmm. And you can just bind to it. So you can back it up just like an ordinary file. You don't have to use special magic backup methods. It's just a file.
I guess this is cool when it's small, yeah?
Well, the SQLite, you'd be surprised how big it will scale. I mean, the SQLite people are quite clear that you don't want to run YouTube off of a SQLite database or anything. But anything at all that most people are contemplating running, you'd be fine using SQLite. Each of our websites, for example, will quite happily work with a SQLite database rather than MySQL. To give you an example, I mean, sorry, we're getting slightly off the point of Django here, but that's one of the reasons why I moved to databases. The other thing is, there's no reason why you couldn't build a SQL thing which, the advantage of being able to use SQL itself, for those of you who've done any database programming, being able to say select star from a table where whatever, rather than write your own parsing routines for a load of text files, is quite a big advantage. Mm. There's no reason why you couldn't build an interface which basically stored things as text files. Microsoft did it. They did a thing called the ODBC text file driver, which basically lets you run SQL against a text file, against a comma-separated variables file, for example, which was dead cool.
Sorry, did you want to say something?
No, go. I'll go now.
The thing I don't understand, well, I mean, I used to be into web stuff to a reasonable degree about two, three years ago, and I'm not into it. I don't tend to do it anymore. Well, I don't do it anymore. There's no tending about it. But it seems like nowadays, if you want to do anything, there's invariably a pre-rolled application out there for you. So if you want to set up a blog or a small website, there's things like WordPress.
Yeah.
You know, for something a bit more complicated in terms of a CMS, there's things like Joomla or Drupal and things like that. Now, are these kinds of frameworks really necessary anymore? Surely most people, like you mentioned, you know, this was born from a paper wanting to set a website up. Do you think most kind of organizations or individuals can just go and use one of these pre-built applications? Do they really need to build these kinds of things? Is this a very, very niche thing now, as opposed to 5 years ago when it was a lot more important?
I personally don't think so. I think Django exists at about the right level. You could, if you look at where Django is, it's not a CMS in itself. It's a mechanism for building CMSs, among other things.
My question was going to be, can I build myself a blog yet?
Absolutely, and people have done so.
And quite easily, by the sound of it.
So PHP is at kind of a slightly lower level. PHP itself doesn't provide anywhere near as much stuff for you as Django does. So there's kind of PHP at a lowish level, and then up above that you've got Django and Rails frameworks, which provide a lot of the stuff for you. Mm. And then up above that itself, you've got if you want a CMS, you go and get a CMS, like Joomla, for example, or Drupal. And there are plenty of people out there using Drupal for it, which is fine. One of the advantages with Django is that you can build something other than CMSs with it, you know. So I was chatting to a guy a while back who built a user interface to a peripheral. It was a radio sort of a thing. So not a database thing at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, you couldn't do that with Joomla, or you wouldn't want to do that with Joomla.
And
you could do it with PHP, but then you miss out on a lot of the stuff that Django provides you.
And the last time I looked into Django, which admittedly was quite some time ago, it seemed like no one was really paying that much attention to it. Is it a thriving project?
There's quite a vibrant community around it now. It's there. A while back, there were two or three different Python frameworks, and the Python web world really hadn't got its act together. But Django pretty much appears to have won out now. It's certainly the leading Python web framework.
Does that mean that people have huge respect and admiration for Harry Potter?
They do, but they have huge respect and admiration for Harry Potter anyway. Anyone who's ever seen Simon Willison speak will be aware that first of all, he speaks at 1,000 miles an hour. And secondly, guy knows his onions, you know?
Does indeed know his onions. You had a question, I believe, El Sweetarini.
The first thing I was going to say, so you're a web guy, as yes. we all know, right?
Web feet guy.
Sausage fingers. Sorry.
Former Q, ladies.
So you're saying that, I mean, I think people have been spotting problems, security problems with PHP for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Do you think people are moving, or web people are looking at Python as being the way forward now?
I think web people are looking at frameworks as being the way forward now. Whether you choose Django,
yeah,
which is in Python, or Rails, which is in Ruby, or Symfony, which is PHP. Depends on your personal likes for different languages. But I mean, there's ASP.NET, which is the same kind of principle.
Well, that was going to be my second question. Are basically people moving towards Python frameworks, or just frameworks in general, as opposed to your kind of your common standalone applications
like hacking your own thing up in
are people moving towards frameworks rather than using WordPress Joomla or Drupal or that kind of thing?
Not users. I think
punters like me.
Yeah, I mean people like you don't want to write an application. No, but Django's a developer tool.
Basically people like me and your average blogger are following what people like you are doing. A year or two behind.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind the difference between you and I is that I'll write applications and you won't. But it wouldn't surprise me if, the last big thing to happen in weblog engines, for example, was WordPress. Mm-hmm. You know, before that there was Movable Type, which was written in Perl. So it wouldn't surprise me if the next big thing that comes along is built on top of a framework. Mm-hmm. There's still a pretty big place for PHP. If you just want to chuck up a very quick thing that just briefly talks to a database, yanks some data out of it and displays it on the screen, PHP is absolutely there for you. And I still use it. I mean, Django's there if you're building if you look at, say, Linkpod on there, Mr. Ben's tiny URL thing. Yeah, that's built in Django, and it's enough of an application to make it worthwhile using it. In the same way that if you're going to bother to write a semi-decent desktop application, then you'll bother to write it in a proper language. If you just want to write something which goes away and parses a couple of text files or something, half the time you just hack together something in Bash.
Yeah, Bash.
PHP in my head, PHP is now kind of like Bash. It's useful for quick tasks, and I'm excluding Symfony, the PHP framework here, and similar PHP frameworks. Using a framework is more like bothering to write a proper application.
It seems like an evolution as well. You know, we've seen PHP was a big thing at one time because that eased a lot of web development stuff. But now these new things have come along, and it sounds pretty interesting. And where can people find out more about Django?
I think it's Django Project.
Bojangles.com.
I think it's DjangoProject.com, but to be honest with you, just stick Django into Google.
Just do a search for Harry Potter and web.
There's also the Django book. They wrote a book and then they published it online as well, nice. Which is at either DjangoBook.com or DjangoBook.org.
So people can learn it easily as well.
In the absence of Christopher the Proctologist, that makes me the last man through the door. So
yes.
It's my dubious pleasure to announce the email segment.
Good man. Okay,
it's the email segment. Right.
And incidentally, it's the email
segment.
He didn't
actually announce it, which is quite good. Do you want to begin then?
I believed you were supposed to begin, but okay, I'll begin the begin.
Begin.
Okay.
Shit before shovel.
I should begin. I've got an email here entitled Non-Free and Free Beer from S.B. Malevich. I believe his first name might be Spike, according to his email address.
Internationally famous film star.
Yeah, exactly. Saving S.B. Malevich.
Hello, gents. I'm madly in love with your show. Thank you very much. I'm madly in love with you, too. Please keep up the good work. You are the wind beneath my wings. Nice.
He's got the right email address. We never knew we were his hero, or possibly her hero.
Right, I've got a vision of British comedy show with Peter Kay singing "You Are the Wind Beneath My Wheels" in a wheelchair. But moving on, a couple of things. I understand that there's a relative question, and I was wondering, in your always oh so humble opinions, according to Linux Freedom Lovers, what non-free or commercial software is considered to be okay to use, and what non-free commercial software is taboo. It seems that some non-free software is more accepted than others. A couple of my friends and I were sitting around trying to think that this would be the official Lug Radio beer. Of what would be the official Lug Radio beer? What
the fuck? Hang on, I think there's two
digression.
I think there's two separate questions in there. First of all, is there any non-free software that we consider acceptable to use?
Cubase.
I'm going to say, Jonathan Bacon Esquire considers Cubase perfectly acceptable, and indeed Mac OS X.
Well, Skype.
The reason why I wanted to read this out is... come on.
I was going to say the canonical example is Flash, but Skype appears to be sneaky.
Canonical
in there as well.
The word, not the company.
Yeah. So the traditional example of something non-free that even people who think I like freedom and it's important will go ahead and use is Flash.
Google?
And Skype is another one, yeah. And then there's the whole web applications discussion.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why I wanted to read this out is, to me, right, the answer to the question is where you sit along the line of either A, being an incredibly proud Windows user and not caring about free software at all, or working for the FSF and possibly being Richard Stallman.
Yeah, or Matt Lee.
And to me, I mean, realistically, if you believe in software freedom, then no proprietary software is okay. But...
Not many people who will push
exactly.
you that far.
I think the modification to that sentence is if you have an extreme view on software freedom or a puritanical view on software freedom.
A pure view would be better. Puritanical is rather derogatory.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was trying to say anyway. So really, it depends how far along that line you sit.
I think everybody should draw their own conclusions.
I think the point he's trying to get across though is that most people don't seem to...
Everybody ignores Flash.
Most people don't seem to... You could build a sort of a continuum of software with it. You know, Flash seems to be more okay than Microsoft Office. Mm, but they're both just as proprietary as one another, so why?
Yep.
Which is an interesting point. I'd be interested in hearing people's theories about why...
In fact, send some email in about that, because that'd be an interesting segment for us to discuss, because I think part of it is in the same way that, you know, a lot of people will choose certain companies to buy coffee from because they treat the farmers better and things like that. You know, it's like you can have the concept. I suppose there could be proprietary software companies who are a little bit more nice and kind of cuddly than some other companies. Like some companies will just absolutely shaft everybody left, right, and center, whereas some other companies they'll be writing proprietary software, but they'll maybe have much more open APIs and more outreach with their customers and things like that. So
we're talking Microsoft and Google. Roughly. Anyway, sorry.
In a word.
Sorry about overrunning that little bit of your email there. It's either that you don't use paragraphs or ACT script doesn't read paragraphs.
My script doesn't read paragraphs.
Right, okay. Is
that because paragraphs are non-free?
No, that's because if you want me to dedicate more than half an hour to something unless you can pay me for it, right? I wrote this script in half an hour and it works well enough.
Software's free, you can pay for the service.
If you don't like it, write your own damn email generation script.
So being Spike Malevich also continues. A couple of my friends and I were sitting around trying to think of what would be the official Lug Radio beer. This created something of a stir, and we eventually negotiated down to two criteria. That's two criteria, according to John O'Bacon.
All right. I was thinking, what the hell are you doing there?
Number one, the beer is preferably cold. Two, the beer is purchased with somebody else's money. What are your thoughts? Thanks a lot for the time. Spike the dingo.
There is only one word. You know what it is, don't you?
No.
It's carling.
Because it isn't.
Carling.
Well, Jono would agree that the beer has to be cold, and I wouldn't, because I'm a real ale drinker.
You would have to decide that it was purchased with somebody else's money.
Real ale.
We would all fundamentally agree that someone else should buy us beer, and indeed, in 1 month from now at Lug Radio Live USA, you will have your chance to buy us beer.
It could be that dude who came along to the party.
The
guy who bought the red stuff.
Oh, no, poor sod. Ah, yeah, the Lug Radio 4th birthday party.
He was a nice guy.
Was a nice guy.
Being Spike Malevich also
it's a long email.
P.S. I nearly pissed myself listening to your shipment of Chris.
Excellent.
Thank you.
We pissed ourselves as well, and Chris got pissed off. Two very quick emails here of things that people are letting us know about. We always encourage you to send in your projects and things that you're working on. Ben Thorpe, Mr. Ben from the forums, friend of the show, he sent us an email saying, given that you gave Pie Room some airtime a few weeks back, I thought you might plug Pie Quizmaster, the released version of the software I wrote for the quiz at last year's Lug Radio Live UK. It works with dual screen and buzz controllers, as you may remember, and we do. And it's written in Python and has GStreamer playback, so it should be suitably Lug Radio fanboy compliant. You can get it at launchpad.net/PieQuizmaster. And it was a really good part of the show.
Hopefully they've fixed the bug that made it crash halfway through the quiz, but never mind.
Yeah,
poor sod, honestly.
Win equals one. the other thing is that we had an email from Dave Walker saying, hi chaps, brilliant show. Just wanting to let you know about another podcast that might interest your listeners. It's the Ubuntu UK podcast. Now, I'm not saying this show is better or more interesting or anything. Wait, yes, I am. That is exactly what I'm saying. Well, fuck off. won't read your URL out then. He says, seriously though, it's a new podcast and would appreciate a pimp from you fine chaps and feedback from your listeners. I had a quick listen to it. It's quite good. And it's got Alan Pope, Popey from the forums, and Tony Tiger on it as well,
indeed.
I believe.
And Dave Murphy, Schwack, another Lug Radio listener, did some of the work. I listened to it as well.
Yep.
And I actually thought I was going to say surprisingly interesting then, which sounds rather harsh, but it's not intended to. But yeah, I thought it was cool.
So you thought it was very interesting, eh?
It's good to see more people doing this kind of thing.
Right.
At this point, I probably ought to point out that the people should not only listen to that podcast, but also Hashtag Radio, because they'll probably complain.
Hashtag Radio.
Oh, yeah, good point and well argued. It's good to hear that people are doing stuff like this.
Thing that made me laugh was in the Hashtag Radio, as in the IRC channel, Nero said the other day that, why didn't we win a prize for Pimp My Lug Radio? We've been pimping Lug Radio for the last God knows how long with Hashtag Radio. And someone said, don't you mean shoeing Lug Radio? I think it was Bruno said that. But yeah, go listen to Hashtag Radio. They do a good job.
Right, email from Bob Prendergast about music players.
He says, cop.
No.
Clearly, it's the cop from Falling Down.
The cop from Falling Down. And indeed, he addresses this point later in his email.
Oh.
is he not then an 80s reggae star?
No. He says, I know you probably answered this type of question before, but I'm too lazy to go back and listen to your entire back catalogue, so I'm going to ask again. And I don't think we have, particularly. He says, what MP3 or OG player can you recommend that is not an iPod? I had a freedom-hating Apple device that I was quite fond of, till some random arsehole decided it would be best to liberate me and break into my car to steal it. Now I'm back to have a $30 256-meg flash player, which sucks, basically, he goes on to say. Recommendations.
I use an iPod.
I have a recommendation, which I've probably mentioned a couple of times on the show now. My MP3 player and OG player is a Kawan iAudio X5. Oh, I just got a mail. Sorry. I'm reading this off the Kawan website as it happens. I was actually looking to see what codecs it supported. But it plays OGs, it plays like MP3s, obviously. I think it plays FLAC and Speaks as well, which is more of the ZIF.org codecs. And another reason why I think this particular model is really cool is because they do upgraded firmware, and they do one which does support DRM and one which doesn't. So you can choose the one which doesn't support DRM.
So if you go to adamsweet.org/commission,
you'll find not only Noros, but the Kawan.
Now, you see, I've heard a lot of good stuff about the Kawan, and they do seem to be reaching out and trying to support the Linux community, which is good. I mean, a mate of mine has an iRiver Clicks, which I found a really nice device to use, but I don't know what it's like in terms of supporting stuff.
Aces and iRiver, and they're nice devices. They just felt a bit clunky when I used them.
Ah, well, the Klix is totally not like that. The whole of the device itself is like a micro switch. It's really, really
easy to
use. You'd be surprised. It's excellent. It's a video player as well.
I just wanted to wrap that up by saying the Kawanai Audio X5 is a couple of years old now, so they've got newer models out. So before you buy one, you might want to check the supported codecs.
And Bob Prendergast does actually say, I'm not an American police inspector, and I've never met one named Prendergast, despite any Michael Douglas movies you may have seen.
Boot in the squads from our friend who's clearly a police officer. Mr. Sweet.
Mr. Sweet, your next email, if you please.
Sorry, I just got Malevich up again. I just want to clear this is a quick one from Peter Sevens, who's one of many people who emailed us to tell us that, in fact, Sony was also involved in the development of the CD.
Yes.
The CD format.
Yeah, we received an enormous avalanche of boot about this particular point, on which Jono was wrong and the rest of us didn't care.
Send us. Well, it's because you had no knowledge whatsoever about Blu-ray. By volunteering some knowledge, I was therefore wrong, admittedly. Stop sending us your
one knows
whinge
nothing,
emails about...
One should say nothing. But yeah, we were wrong, we get it.
I'm just going to shut up in future. Shut up before you say anything. Language. We've had an email from, I think it's pronounced Thilo Fennig, or Thilo Fennig, saying, LeGradio has lost its charm.
I have to agree.
we think it's bollocks.
Is that because Chris, isn't it?
He says, hi, I really liked your shows, but find that since you have a new website in some months, and some months, your show is becoming less interesting. So you have more and more meta bling bling. Let's look at the last show. Your shipment of Chris has arrived. Okay, that's content. Okay. The results of the Pimp My LeGradio competition, that's meta bling bling. Some more details about the up-and-coming LeGradio Live USA, same. Cult of Celebrity, not really facts. We receive a plaintive and heartfelt cry from the help of Asa Raskin. Again, meta bling bling. Your emails to the same. I remember what I liked most when your strong viewpoints, interviews, and the open discussions. The last show that I liked was Season 5, Episode 7. But previously I liked every show. I guess you are more popular now, so maybe you feel what you do now is better than before. And I also have witnessed often that while something becomes more popular, it turns me off more and more. I have listened to your shows since years, and I now start to not care about new shows. Thing is, I like to get updated about the newest and hottest topics in Linux, and I don't really care about any meta thing or competitions. I also like to get these things condensed in a short period of time, and I also like some hard talk if topics are questionable. Just wanted to give you that feedback. You have to decide what you make out of it. Maybe more users like your shows more now than before. Now, my viewpoint on this is that particular show that Thilo is referring to, we did have a competition that ended and we did have a competition that started. So those were two segments that were... He refers to it as meta bling bling. I refer to it as LeGradio segments, I think. And one thing we're always very conscious of is to not talk too much about things that are specific to LeGradio, apart from LeGradio Live, which is something that... You know, we put a lot of time and effort in. And we try to have at least two or three segments in every show which are about a specific topic. And we look through Season 5, and pretty much every show, apart from this one, follows that recipe. But rest assured, Thilo, we are aware of this.
I mean, for me, I perhaps understood his point about that show in retrospect, but I think the rest of the season hasn't been like that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're talking about LeGradio Live quite a lot because we're building up to an event.
Yeah.
And that's what you do.
And to be honest with you, skip over the segment. We put the times on the website. If you don't like a segment, don't listen to it, you know? It's like, it's quite simple to press fast forward a few times. But rest assured, we do want to make the show as varied and as interesting as possible. And the best way to make that happen is send us in your show ideas or go to the forums and add your show ideas there.
Absolutely. Email from Eric Green. He called it MP3 Og and How I Came to Love Freedom.
It's a nice email.
It is actually a nice email. He says, I'm not much of a music buff, but about a year and a half ago, I started to get an interest in purchasing an iPod. Looking around, I found the iPods cost more than I was willing to spend, and then I put the idea on hold. Around this same time, I'd installed Ubuntu on my desktop and went looking for more Linux info. I found LeGradio. I will unashamedly admit that it was because of finding your show that I finally broke down and bought an MP3 player. I went with a 1GB Creative Zen Nano Plus, because it was less expensive than the comparable iPods, and it didn't persuade me into using iTunes. After listening to all of Seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 to catch up, I realised that I inadvertently hated freedom.
Oops.
It's a terrible realisation when that comes to you, I must admit it. I listened to a show in season 4, coincidentally about a year ago, where you discussed MP3 and Ogg Vorbis, etc., and I was disappointed that my player could not play the Freedom format. Recently, I attended a local computer show, and I bought another player, a SanDisk Sansa E260.
It's a snappy name, isn't it?
It was a 4 gig player with video capability, and it'll take a 2 gig micro SD card at a price I couldn't pass up. It was an impulse purchase. After getting home, I looked around on the internet to find out more about it, and lo and behold, found out that once again I hated Freedom.
Hadn't at this point thought of looking up the Freedom players and buying one of those.
This knowledge, however, came with a silver lining. I found out about Rockbox, which is an alternative firmware that runs on lots of quite a few
I believe
players,
a previous candidate for most pointless project in existence.
No, that was, iPod Linux.
Sorry. Okay.
Which was just annoying and rubbish.
/ Adam Sweet begs forgiveness of
Rockbox is actually quite cool, I think.
Yeah, because it's not full of inane bullshit. It's actually about making a better media player.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To refer to the iPod Linux as inane bullshit. Come and exhibit at Look Radio Live, honest.
I was thrilled to find out this replacement firmware would run on my new player, giving me benefits beyond my wildest dreams, like increased battery life, more control of my listing preferences, tons of customizability. It'll allow a micro SDHC card up to 32 gigabytes. It's open source, and it supports Ogg. And he's really pleased about this.
SD card of 32 gigabytes?
Right. He says, and now, because of Rockbox, I can say with pride, I love Freedom. And he really wanted to tell someone about it and decided to tell us.
That's quite cool.
And now you've told all of our listeners. That's fantastic.
And I thought that was a really lovely email, actually. Mm. I mean, Rockbox, I've always been a bit down on Rockbox because for the same reason that I'm down on people who buy iPhones with the intention of jailbreaking them. Because I can't think why the hell you'd deliberately buy a broken product with the intention of having to fix it yourself.
Yeah.
But there, Rockbox has rescued that guy, and he's immensely happy with it. So I withdraw my previous comments about Rockbox.
And he loves the Freedom these days. One thing I'd like to mention, not me, I wasn't here at the time, did Look Radio invent the phrase hating freedom? Because it's fucking brilliant.
It seems like there was a period of time in the Look Radio history where if anybody said anything that was vaguely in disagreement with the Free Software Foundation, it was, well, you clearly hate freedom.
Yes.
So I'd like to think that we've added that to the general lexicon of the human race.
I was really pleased with it. Sorry, Eric something? Eric Green, was it?
Raymond.
Eric, it's gone. But Eric Green, that was it. Yeah,
but I thought that was a really, really nice email.
It was. I actually had a moment there for a second.
I did. Thank you. You have
proper hand in pocket.
It was vigorously scratching his leg.
I'll be honest with you, Eric. I don't know about these two because they hate freedom. But emails like that are why I do this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So stop sending your emails in.
Shut up, man. Didn't you say you? Didn't we decide you had to shut up not 30 seconds ago?
That's a good point. I've got two emails here that I'm going to read in quick succession. The first one from Neil McLaren, who wants to say, I just wanted to say how much improved the sound quality was of the latest episode of the show, and that's season 5, episode 13.
Yeah.
Much better than season 5, episode 12, although I think the high quality MP3 is a little on the large side. Keep up the good work, guys. Neil.
Thank you.
Sorry, do you want to say something?
I just can say we are aware of people's comments. Everyone brutally shooed us about the stereo. We have now fixed that at the cost of the fact that Jono's master MP3 that he generates is now the high-quality MP3, which is what is 80 megabytes. We are still working on it, and a lot of people have sent in suggestions for lame settings and so on. There's a chap called Thomas Nyberg and Pete Savage helped me out, and we've had some suggestions on the forums, and thank you. R. Smith on the forums has been quite helpful in this.
This was discovered.
We do appreciate the fact that you're doing this, and we are.
Yeah.
Every episode, I'm trying a bit harder to make it better.
This was discovered when Ack sent me an email with a little snippet of each of the different stereo encodings that you can have, and then we realized that the best encoding was when Ack converted the stereo MP3 master into a stereo MP3 master of the same quality and the same bitrate. And then Ack said, hang on a second, why don't we just use the stereometry masses? Like, oh yeah.
The worst thing about it was it took about 25 minutes to dump it to a WAV and then re-encode it.
Exactly the same.
And then it was exactly the same, which is a bit stupid. I mean, the worst thing about it was, I do believe when I did the snippets of it for Jono to listen to, I actually encoded one of them at a higher bitrate than the master was, which, as I understand, doesn't work properly. Yeah, you can't magic more quality out of nothing.
Yeah, no, so that's like taking a picture of someone on Facebook and blowing it up so you can put it on your wall.
What, like in Blade Runner?
Anyway, moving on.
Like in John O'Bacon's bedroom, incidentally. The other email I wanted to follow that with quickly was Chris Davidson, entitled "I Don't See the Problem." Prompted by the bollocking you received in episode 13 of season 5, I usually download the high quality OG and really don't see why everyone is complaining about stereo or heavy breathing. They can all fuck right off. Some people place too much emphasis on audio quality and not enough on audio content. And ignoring Thilo Felig's comment, I broadly agree with you, to be honest. However, the fact is that you were listening to the OG, and everyone was complaining specifically about the MP3, I think.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, they were. I mean,
but thanks. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's...
So the difference between the two is that ogg-enc, you just, if you want to encode a WAV to ogg, you just say ogg-enc-q and then the quality number, and that's it. And Lame's got like 40 billion options.
Yeah.
Incidentally, right? I'm not sure if we mentioned this in the last show, because I was still drunk from the night before in the last show. But all the people complaining about the quality of the MP3, listen to the fucking OG instead.
Yeah.
Freedom.
Yeah.
A lot of them are going to say it doesn't work on our MP3 players or whatever, but yeah.
Go on iAudio X5.
Shut up.
I was just at adamsweet.org.
Sales at adamsweet.org.
I ought to sell stuff, you know.
Yeah,
sell
your body for medical science is what you need to sell. Ak, God of War, is the subject of the next email, which is from Yoni Rabkin.
I like this one.
This is weird. I don't know whether I'm getting shooing here.
This is actually really quite deeply concerning. he says, or she says, some time ago, I was doing the laundry while listening to Lug Radio on a portable media player of no distinction. There is something about Lug Radio that makes me feel at ease around dirty naked.
I'm with you there, brother, actually.
Move on. Let's just not comment on that.
Glaze over. Nobody noticed.
This was during the Israeli Hezbollah war, and as a citizen of Haifa, we were regularly getting hammered by rockets. I clearly remembered listening to Ak talk about something and was wondering why on earth do they have air raid sirens in the recording? By the time my brain realized the sirens were in fact not in the recording, the windows shook with rocket blasts and me and my wife once again took cover. Ever since I listened to Ak's voice with a bit more trepidation, cut your own wood and it will warm you twice. That's really fucking weird.
I did find it slightly disturbing. I'm not sure whether I'm being accused of the rocket thing.
I think this maybe just slightly beats the email that we got from the guy who says, Ak said something and a headphone popped out.
I think that this guy's made a Pavlovian association between Ak's voice and the incoming missiles.
Yeah.
Which is the fucking amusing, to be honest.
I mean, one of the interesting things about it is that the guys in Israel, I didn't know we had any Israeli listeners. Oh, presumably we have.
Not that have written to us.
It's really cool hearing about people who listen to the show from different. I mean, we had someone writing from the Philippines. I thought, my God.
Some dude mailing from Botswana or something. Yeah. The other couple of shows. Yeah. This is madness.
It's cool, isn't it?
I find it fascinating. It's really, really cool.
So, if you're on an oil rig with internet connectivity or on Antarctica, please send us an email.
We should send a t-shirt to the weirdest country. Like the weirdest, obscurest, oddball fucking
Unga Bunga land.
Yeah. Unga Bunga land.
There is not anywhere called Unga Bunga land.
It's the unit of currency, the Bunga.
I should tell my Unga Bunga joke at some point, but maybe not now.
Tell your Unga Bunga joke, go on.
No, it's quite long.
No, go on.
Really? You're complaining about the length of the show.
Well, you know, fuck them.
Right, there's these two dudes walking through the jungle, right? And they're pretty lost.
Is this the one about the cherries?
No.
No.
All okay. of a sudden, in the distance, they've been walking for days. They're starving. They're thirsty. And they're really going to die. And in the distance, they hear jungle drums. And they're like, fucking hell, jungle drums. That means people, at least. And they'll be able to tell us where we are and how to get out and that. So they're getting nearer and nearer to these jungle drums. And as they get quite close to the jungle drums, the jungle drums stop. And they're like, fuck. It said that if you walk towards jungle drums and they stop, you're in deep shit. Mm. And out of nowhere, these big jungle warriors appear with bones through their nose and bowls through their lips. You know, all that weird shit. Fucking
bowls through their lips.
You've seen people, you know, people with bowls through their lips.
Mario's got a bowl in his lip.
A bowl?
People do that, man.
It's a clog.
A clog.
A clog.
A clog. Okay. Moving on. So anyway, these guys appear and the head...
Like the Dutch shoes made out of wood?
Yeah.
What do they mean, your lip? Why would you have a fucking bowl in your lip?
People do, man. Anyway. You know the people that want the curly wires around their necks, so their necks are about
network cable.
A foot and a half long. But anyway, so these jungle warriors appear.
The picture.
And, yeah, these warriors appear, and the largest and biggest, scariest looking warrior steps forward and says, "You have wandered into our sacred burial ground. You have desecrated the memory of our ancestors. You have two choices. You have Unga Bunga."
Desecrated.
Desecrated,
sure. Like coconut.
Shut up. I was just thinking that.
"You have wandered into our sacred burial ground and desecrated the memory of our ancestors. You have a choice, Unga Bunga or death." And the first guy goes, "Well, fuck me. Death doesn't sound like a laugh." I'll take Unga Bunga, please. And
it's the joke about the cherry. Shut up. Carry on.
And the first guy, every warrior in the village takes it in turns to do him up the arse. And
for God's sake.
The guy's lying on the floor going, "Well, I'm not really pleased with that choice." And, and so...
Statement of the year. I'm not very pleased with that choice.
Yes, so warrior number one steps forward again to the other guy and says, "So now it is your choice. It is Unga Bunga or death." And he's like, "Fuck me. I don't like the look of Unga Bunga. I'll take death, please." And he goes, "Death. By Unga Bunga." So anyway, on with the show.
That joke is poor.
Is what That's it my is. Favourite joke ever.
What's brown and sticky?
A stick.
A stick.
Shut up.
Have we got any more emails?
We have one more email from a guy called Brian Chesky, who writes in to say, "We have created a new housing website for Lug Radio Live. It's called Airbed and Breakfast," which is Airbed and...
I thought it was Air Biscuit and Breakfast.
No.
Care Bear and Biscuit.
Care Bear and Biscuit.
Everyone be quiet.
I believe this is Thilo Fennig's point all over again, isn't it? Meta content.
www.airbedandbreakfast.com. And apparently, people living in San Francisco can list their places, their houses on the website and then rent them out to people who are visiting Lug Radio Live.
Yep.
So, yeah, go and have a look at airbedandbreakfast.com. Thank you very much, Brian Chesky.
Sorry. Anyway. You arse.
Right.
Do we have any more?
No. That's all the emails, I think. Thank you very much, everybody. Send in your emails to show@lugradio.org for the next show, and that's us done for another 2 weeks.
Particularly, I'd like to hear from more people who've got their freedom stories to share.
Yeah, and I'd like to hear from more people from different parts of the world. We hear about a lot of people from various European countries and the US, but we don't typically hear from that many people in Asia and the Middle East as well, so... If you listen to the show and you live in a weird country, send us an email.
You've definitely just encouraged people to mail us. You pellet.
That's the convincing that was.
Right, and Chris will be back in the next episode. It'll be good to have his royal arseness back. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.